All right, so thank you. I feel a little bit like a fish out of water at this meeting because I'm used to thinking about very, very small scales. I consider a large simulation one where the volume is, 10 cubic parsecs. So the nice thing about this is that the people who know all of the problems with what I'm going to tell you mostly aren't here. All right, and I'm also glad to come after Brant, partly because he introduced a lot of the background material, for the material I'm going to talk about, and partly because I was glad to see he too uses Google image search to look up funny pictures for his talks. This is what you get if you put in secretive cloud. So, and you can see my collaborators up here. So, I'm going to begin by reviewing some embarrassing observational facts about star formation, which Brant sort of introduced for us. And then I'm going to walk through a mostly analytic picture of how we turn gas into stars. And what I'm going to try and do is provide the microphysical perspective on the macrophysical processes that Brant just talked about. I'm going to try and sort of delve into the detailed physics much more, but of course I'm not going to have pretty movies and cosmological simulations and such. So, observations. This is the proper attitude of theorists towards observations, incidentally. All right, and I'll begin with the same point Brant made. Stars don't form in gas. They form in molecular gas. Here's the H1 for a collection of nearby galaxies. And here's the star formation. And you can see the star formation is much, much more concentrated. And here's the Kennicott plot again, showing that star formation correlates very, very well with the H2 and very, very poorly with the H1. And a second thing that you should notice about this plot, and this will come up later, is the H1 is sort of hitting a wall here. You don't get H1 surface densities more than about 10 solar masses per square parsec, roughly. All right, and this is an interesting observational fact that we'd like to be able to explain. Why does the H1 saturate there? But of course, even once you've made H2, star formation is slow. And you can convince yourself of this just by counting. In the Milky Way, within the solar circle, we have about 10 to the 9 solar masses of gas and giant molecular clouds. All right. These clouds have densities of about 100. Their free fall times are, 3 or 4 million years. All right? Well, if these were collapsing on a free fall time scale, the star formation rate would be a few hundred solar masses a year instead of a few solar masses per year. So there's this mismatch of a factor of 100 between the star formation rate you would expect if molecular clouds were in collapse and the star formation rate you would actually observe. And if you repeat this exercise for nearby galaxies, you get about this same factor of 100. You even get it if you look at a starburst galaxy. So here's ARB220. This is my prototypical nearby starburst. All right. The ISM mass is about the same as the Milky Way. It's about 2 × 10⁻⁹ solar masses in molecular gas. All right, and it's basically just what you'd get if you took the Milky Way and compressed its entire ISM into the central kiloparsec or so. All right, so the density is much, much higher. Instead of 100 per cubic centimeter, it's more like 10⁴. The free fall time is correspondingly lower. You do long division again, and you get 5,000 solar masses a year. The observed star formation rate is about 50 solar masses per year. So even in a starburst, supposedly the system that's converting itself into stars really rapidly, there's a factor of 100 discrepancy between the observed star formation rate and the star formation rate you would get if the molecular clouds were just in free fall collapse. And in fact, the same factor of 100 shows up if you just concentrate on the dense gas. So this is a plot from one of Leo's papers. This is molecular gas surface density versus star formation rate. And these dashed lines are just lines of constant depletion time. That is, at the observed star formation rate, how long would it take to turn all of the gas into stars? All right, and here's the data. And you can see that's a depletion time for around a giga year, which corresponds to about 100 free fall times for the density of these molecular clouds. So that's just the argument I gave you before. If we repeat this exercise instead of for CO, for HCN gas, and this is a plot from Gao and Solomon, we come up with about the same number. It's about 100 free fall times to turn all the gas into stars. Now, this is very interesting because HCN is a molecule with a much, much higher critical density than CO. CO you can start exciting at densities of around 100 per cubic centimeter, the typical density in a giant molecular cloud. This molecule requires a density closer to 10⁵ per cubic centimeter in order to be excited. So even if we concentrate on the parts of a galaxy denser than about 10⁵ particles per cubic centimeter, So that's a free fall time that's lower than the free fall time in GMCs by a factor of about 30. We still find that it takes about 100 free fall times to turn all the gas into stars. And this is a plot of mine, which Brandt showed. If you repeat this exercise for a bunch of different ways of tracing the gas, here are giant molecular clouds in CO, here's HCN. You can repeat this for infrared dark clouds in the Milky Way. This is a population of clouds detected in infrared absorption against the galactic background. You can repeat this for an individual star-forming region, the Orion Nebula Cluster. All right, and here's an upper limit from another tracer. What you find is that the ratio of freefall time to depletion time is always a couple percent. So there seems to be a sort of universal star formation rate of about 2% per freefall time, independent of the density at which you choose to measure the gas mass and the freefall time. This suggests that molecular clouds have a sort of self-similar hierarchical structure. That is, if I look at a cloud in CO, what I find is most of that cloud isn't collapsing to stars. All the star formation is occurring in these special high-density regions within it that contain 2% of the mass, and 98% of the mass is doing nothing. But if I zoom in to one of those special high-density regions traced by HCN, I find exactly the same thing. In fact, most of that gas isn't turning itself into stars. Only about 2% of it is. So every time I zoom in, what I find is this same structure of a low-density envelope that's sort of passive, and all the star formation is special high-density regions. So another way of putting this is that so far it's turtles all the way down. All right. Every time you zoom in on a star-forming cloud, what you find is, well, the star formation isn't occurring in most of this cloud. It's only occurring in these high-density regions within it that occupy about 2% of the mass. So what are the implications of this? Well, first of all, for galaxy simulators out there, and I know there are a fair number of you, the bad news is you can simulate H2 formation, but after that, you're sort of out of luck. And the reason you're sort of out of luck is because what we've shown is that star formation is inefficient down to a density of 10 to the 5 per cubic parsec. That corresponds to a physical size scale in molecular clouds of about a parsec. So that is, whatever's regulating star formation, whatever's making it slow and inefficient, must operate at size scales below a parsec. So unless your galaxy simulation is going to resolve a parsec, you're more or less stuck with a subgrid model for turning gas into stars. There's no way around that. All right. Here's the good news. Once the molecules form, you've got this universal star formation law. You turn a couple percent of the gas into stars per freefall time, and that's true regardless of what freefall time your simulation is capable of resolving. So the bad news is you need a subgrid model. You're stuck with it. The good news is you can use a very, very simple one. But here's where I come in for the microphysics. I would like to figure out what physics is responsible for these observations. That is, what determines what fraction of the gas is molecular and thus eligible to form stars, and what physics sets this universal few percent per freefall time once you've got the molecular gas. All right, so it's turtles all the way down. Here is a turtle. I'm going to try and walk you through from H1 to stars. All right, so step one, making molecules. Well, if we look around at the Milky Way, what we see is that molecular clouds are the inner parts of giant atomic molecular complexes. I've got this huge cloud of gas, and the outer parts of this cloud are atomic gas, and only the inner parts are molecular. All right, and here's my cartoon. The reason the outer parts of this complex are atomic is because there's an interstellar radiation field, which has lots of Lyman-Werner photons that are capable of destroying H2 molecules. The inner parts of this cloud are molecular because this outer part acts as a shield. The few molecules in here and the dust absorb Lyman-Werner photons until I get down to the point where I've absorbed them all, and then I get H2. So I'd like to have a theory that will let me figure out how big is this blue region compared to this yellow region. That is, how much of the gas is in this phase versus in this one. So let's step into the physics that controls this. There are two basic physical equations that describe this system. They're very simple. Chemical equilibrium and radiative transfer. All right? And the physical meaning is easy. The rate at which H2 molecules form, primarily on the surfaces of dust grains, that's the dominant formation mechanism once you've got any dust present, balances the rate at which they're dissociated by interstellar UV photons. All right? So this is just the number of targets times the cross-section per target times the fraction of absorptions that yield a dissociation from quantum mechanics, this is about 10%, times the photon flux. All right? So that's one equation. The second equation is simply says the decrease in radiation intensity as I travel along a ray is given by the rate at which photons get absorbed by H2 molecules plus the rate at which they get absorbed by dust grains. All right, so given these two equations, we're going to solve an idealized problem. Consider a spherical cloud whose radius is r and whose density is n, and I'll fix the dust opacity, and I'll fix the rate coefficient describing H2 formation, and I'll just take this cloud and I'll immerse it in a uniform isotropic radiation field where I'll specify the number density of dissociating UV photons at infinity, E0 star. And given this idealized problem, I can solve these two equations and figure out what the molecular fraction is. Now, you could do this numerically, but I'm lazy. I'd rather do it analytically. And it turns out to depend on two dimensionless numbers. All right? One of these is just a description of how big the cloud is. That's tau r is just the dust optical depth from the edge to the center of the cloud. Not surprisingly, that makes a difference. But the one that really makes a difference is this psi. It's a normalized radiation field. All right, and it involves a product of the dust opacity and the fraction and the number density of photons divided by the gas density times this rate coefficient. All right, and I'll explain what psi means in a bit more detail in a second. But just to convince you that I've got it, all right, this is a comparison of a numerical calculation of rate of transfer versus this analytic model. So this quantity chi is equal to psi modulo factor of order unity. All right, and so what's plotted here is the solid line is the analytic prediction for the thickness of the H1 shielding layer around a molecular cloud. All right, so the solid line is what we get from our analytic theory. The red and blue symbols here are the results of numerical calculations done with Jason Tumlinson's H2 formation and radiative transfer code. And we're varying the radiation intensity by 6 decades. We're varying the metallicity by 2.5 decades. We're trying 2 different dust grain models, and what you can see is that our analytic theory reproduces the results of the numerical calculation to better than 50% over this huge range. All right, and so this shows that this chi here, or psi, the normalized radiation field, is really what controls what's going on. And so we can make a plot of just what's the H2 fraction by volume in this case as a function of this radiation parameter psi and the cloud size tau. All right, so we have a theory that tells us what fraction of the gas is in which phase. How can we apply this in galaxies? Now, the challenge here is we need to know this normalized radiation parameter, which involves these things that are not necessarily easy to figure out. The dust opacity, the UV radiation intensity, the number density of the gas, and the rate coefficient for H2 formation. A priori, I know none of these. So, can I do better than that? Well, it turns out that I can pull a couple of tricks. First of all, this ratio, sigma dust divided by the rate coefficient. Well, basically, these are just measures of what's the total surface area of dust grains mixed into the gas. All right, sigma dust is just what's the surface area of dust grains available to block light, and r, the rate coefficient, is just what's the surface area of dust grains available to serve as reaction sites for making H2 molecules. So that ratio, both of these scale more or less with metallicity. It's just how much dust do I have in the gas. And so that ratio is about constant. All right, each of these varies individually, but their ratio is about constant. All right, well, that's part of this. What about this E0 star over N? That's the ratio of the photon number density to the gas number density. Well, I can pull another trick. The trick is that really what I care about for the purposes of shielding a molecular cloud is the density in the cold atomic medium. All right, and the reason is shielding is an N-squared process. I care about the dense phase, not the diffuse phase. So I care about the cold atomic medium because that's denser. So I want to know what is N in the cold neutral medium, the CNM. It turns out that that's not independent of zero star. So these are FGH curves for the Milky Way from Wolfire et al. So the plot here is showing the number density of the gas versus pressure for gas that's in radiative equilibrium. All right, and what you can see is that you get this region of bistability. You get this region where you can have pressure balance, and there are two phases, a warm phase and a cold phase. And that's how we think the ISM is structured. There's a warm phase and a cold phase, and they're roughly in pressure balance. The cold phase has a limited range of densities. I can't have arbitrary densities in my cold phase. It's only about a factor of 10 this cold phase is allowed to occupy. But these curves are generated for different radiation intensities. The density that my cold phase is allowed to have is more or less linearly proportional to the radiation intensity. And that's just a result of, if I turn up the UV radiation field, then in order to shed heat, because I've turned up the heating rate, my cold gas has to get denser. And it has to get denser more or less linearly in proportion to the UV radiation field. So this ratio, E0 star over N, is roughly a constant. Now the cute thing is that means that my number psi is roughly a constant. In all galaxies everywhere in the Milky Way, this is a constant of nature, more or less controlled by quantum mechanics and nothing else. All right, so I've got my constant of nature. What I can do with it is make a prediction for how much atomic gas it takes to shield molecules as a function of metallicity. So this is just a prediction for the H2 content. And what I'm plotting here is on the x-axis, the total gas surface density. On the y-axis is the surface density of H1 or H2. So the solid lines are H2, the dashed lines are H1. And these are just plots for different metallicities. All right, metallicity does enter into this. And so what you can see is I get this pattern of I get a maximum amount of H1, and the maximum amount I get depends on the metallicity, and after that everything's H2. All right? So I have a theory for the molecular contents as a function of surface density and metallicity. Let's compare that to reality. So here I'm comparing to two surveys of the H1 and H2 content of galaxies, Bim of Song and the Things survey. All right, and so what I've done is I've taken the galaxies in these surveys, and I've binned them by metallicity, and then for every pixel or every point or every ring, depending on the survey, I've just plotted total gas surface density versus either H1 surface density or H2 surface density. All right, so the green line in each panel is my theoretical prediction, and my theoretical prediction winds up being an upper limit on the H1 content, because I don't know how clumpy the gas is. These observations do not resolve individual molecular cloud complexes. They're sort of kiloparsec size averaging. But what you can see is that I recover two very important features of this data. First of all, as I mentioned before, the H1 saturates. There's a maximum amount of atomic gas I can get, because if I try and add more gas, it all turns molecular. It saturates at about 10 solar masses per square parsec, and the saturation depends on metallicity. At low metallicity, so this is, you know, less than half solar or half a dex below solar, I can have more H1 than at high metallicity. This is up to 10 to the 0.5 times solar. So I recover the way the metallicity affects the H1 saturation column. Conversely, and this is more or less saying the same thing, I recover that there's a minimum column density you need to start making molecules, more or less, and that minimum is different at different metallicities. For low metallicity, you need a fair column to start making molecules. This is, you know, 30 solar masses per square parsec or so. All right, now, this is interesting for people who are worried about cosmology and dwarf galaxies and things like that, because these are very low metallicity systems. They're going to require very high column densities to start making molecules. And, you know, we've barely started to explore the implications of this, but it seems likely there are cosmological implications. All right. So I've told you about making molecules, yes? Well, so the green here is, so on this right-hand plot, the green is the prediction, all right, and it's a predicted lower limit, as I said, because of this because of the clumpiness of the gas. So I don't know what's going on with this galaxy. I'm not sure about this. But here you can see the stuff is pretty closely hugging that green line. And so this green line here is different than this green line here is different than this one here. So if I were to overplot this data for this low metallicity, it would wind up about here on this plot. It would be well below the line. So the data is sort of hugging the line. All right, incidentally, I should mention that for the most part, the blue data hugs the line better than the red data, and that's because the blue data is higher resolution. All right, so I've told you about making molecules. Now let me tell you about turning molecules into stars and doing it slowly. Now, there's a clue in the structure of molecular clouds. And this clue is that if you look at a molecular cloud, what you find is that it has this sort of core envelope structure. There's a little bit of the mass, which is in these dense structures, these cores. and this is a plot of this is a column density map of the and in between the cores there's this low density diffuse medium. And this low density diffuse medium is actually where most of the mass is. Mass wise, 98% of the mass is in this stuff, 2% is in those little cores. If you do simulations of just a turbulent isothermal medium, which we think is a reasonable description of a molecular cloud, you get this same sort of core envelope structure. So this is an MHD simulation done by Li et al. Of a giant molecular cloud, and you see the same structure. There are these dense cores and this diffuse medium, this diffuse envelope, and most of the mass is in this envelope, not in the cores. So maybe this is a hint as to why star formation is so slow. I'm going to make a theory based on it. We know that on large scales, giant molecular clouds are roughly virial. This virial ratio, which is basically just a measure of kinetic energy divided by potential energy, is about 1. All right, so I look at an entire GMC, I've got equal amounts of kinetic and potential energy. Now I'm going to appeal to something I know about the nature of supersonic turbulence, which is that it obeys a line width size relation. That is, if I take a box of a certain size, L, and I ask, what's the velocity dispersion inside this box? It depends on the size of the box. The bigger the box I take, the larger velocity dispersion I'll measure within it. And it depends on the box size is roughly L to the 1/2 power. All right, so I can define a characteristic scale here called the sonic length. And that just means how big a box do I have to pick so that the non-thermal velocity dispersion I measure within it is equal to the sound speed. All right, that's what this lambda S is. It's the size of the box I have to pick so the non-thermal and thermal velocity dispersions are the same. All right, so here's my giant molecular cloud. Let me pick just a random subregion within it. Just going to pick some box at random. Its size is L. Well, I pick this random region. The mass goes like L cubed. You know, it's just mass is proportional to volume for a random region. All right, so the kinetic energy is going to go like L to the 4th power, and that's because the mass is like L cubed. Sigma squared is like L. All right, so mass times sigma squared is like L to the 4th. Potential L to the 5th, and that's because it's mass squared divided by length, L to the 6th divided by L. All right, why did I walk you through that algebra? Well, I did it because this implies that if kinetic and potential energy are equal over this entire cloud, for my random subregion, the kinetic energy is much bigger than the potential energy. It just goes down less quickly. So the average region within a giant molecular cloud is gravitationally unbound. It's got much more kinetic energy than potential energy. That's exactly what we saw in those simulations, and it's exactly what we see in observed molecular clouds. Most of the gas is moving around too fast to be gravitationally bound. But now I can turn this argument around. Suppose I want to find a special region, a region that's denser than average and that is gravitationally bound. Is star formation occurs only in those special regions. Energy or equivalent to the Ram pressure. Well, what has to be true about such a region? If you do a little algebra, what you'll find is that that's equivalent to saying that the Jeans length in that region is smaller than the sonic length. All right, where the Jeans length is this thing that depends on density you're all familiar with. Well, what are the implications of that? I also know something else about supersonic turbulence. I know that it generates a distribution of densities in the molecular gas that has a log-normal form. That is, if I put my probe at a random spot in a molecular cloud and I ask, what's the local density? And I do this a lot of times, I'll wind up with a distribution that has this particular form. Well, now I can combine my facts. Here's the distribution of density. Here is this critical line at which the Jeans length equals the sonic length. If I'm to the right of this line, the Jeans length is smaller than the sonic length, this stuff is dense enough that I expect it to be gravitationally bound. I can then just integrate everything to the right of this line, and I've figured out what fraction of my molecular cloud is gravitationally bound. It winds up depending on two dimensionless numbers, this virial ratio alpha and the Mach number in the molecular cloud. Here's just a little animation showing you how. As I increase the virial ratio, it gets harder and harder to get bound stuff. This line moves to the right. As I change the Mach number, the shape of this distribution changes. And when I put those two together and I just ask what fraction of the mass is to the right of this line, that's roughly what it is. Now this is very interesting because I told you this number is always about 1 in a molecular cloud. This number is about 30. This is why the star formation rate per freefall time is a few percent. It's a few percent for any object that is virial in the sense that alpha is about 1, and supersonically turbulent, Mach number is, you know, 30-ish. That explains this quantitatively, this sort of 2% per freefall time. So we can put this together. We can say, all right, I want to explain the Kennicott law. I know what fraction of the gas is in molecules. I know what, for those molecules, what fraction of the star, of the gas turns into stars per freefall time. So this is a prediction that, Chris McKee and I published in 2005. So the dashed line there is the Kennicott relation, the Kennicott 98. The solid line was our theoretical model, all right, and the pluses and asterisks are Kennicott's galaxies. Now, this is not a prediction. This is a postdiction, because, of course, we knew about the Kennicott data before we published this. Here's where the prediction part comes in. This is some new data from Ted Wider at Caltech on low surface brightness galaxies. So those dots there. The dashed line is the theoretical prediction that we published in 2005. You can see it more or less goes right through the new data for these low surface brightness galaxies. All right, and the primary effect that's going on here is just this is not molecular gas. Most of the gas here is non-molecular, and that's why you start falling below the standard Kennicott law. All right, let me go on to my last topic, and then I'll end. Step 3, stellar feedback. All right, so I've told you a lot about the star formation law, but I've left out one key element. All observed molecular clouds have this virial ratio of about 1. But GMC lifetimes are something like 20 to 30 million years, and the crossing time of a molecular cloud is only about 7 million years. Now, that's a problem because we know that supersonic isothermal turbulence, if you do nothing else, decays quite quickly. It decays away in a crossing time. So if I had no injection of energy, in 7 million years, my molecular cloud would no longer have alpha of 1. It would go into freefall collapse. It would turn itself into stars. It would violate all sorts of observational constraints. Why doesn't this happen? In fact, what we see is that in nearby galaxies, giant molecular clouds have quite similar properties. They all look about the same. They all have about the same surface density. So my hypothesis is that star formation feedback is the agent that regulates the density in giant molecular clouds and maintains virial balance. Here's an example of this feedback. It's an H2 region. It's the H2 region 30 Doradus. So I'm going to make a very simple model, and I'll be trying to do better in the future. This is nothing but an energy budget argument. All right, I've got my molecular cloud. I'm going to keep track of the mass in gas, the mass in stars, the radius, the overall expansion or contraction, the velocity dispersion. And for this 1D model, I can write down the exact virial theorem and the exact energy balance. So I've got an energy loss term that involves the decay of turbulence. I've got an energy gain term that comes from H2 regions driving explosions into this medium. So here's a simulation of what I mean. This is an MHD simulation of an H2 region going off into a molecular cloud, and you can see it drives this blast wave that stirs up turbulence. So I run these models, and here's what I get. So these are just 100 different models in which all I've done is I've drawn from the IMF differently. And versus time, my virial ratio indeed stays about 1. My column density through my molecular clouds stays about stable. They start contracting due to the decay of turbulence, but then star formation feedback increases the turbulence, and they wind up in rough equilibrium. And the depletion time, that is the rate at which they're turning themselves into stars, also stays about constant. And this is a good match to what we observe. Giant molecular clouds have virial ratios between about 0.5 and 2, which are the simulations reproduce. And they all have densities of about 10 to the 22 per square centimeter, which again, the simulations reproduce. So we can explain the virial balance and equilibrium structure of molecular clouds just by considering the internal feedback created by star formation within one. All right, so I'm at my conclusions. Star formation is slow, and it's slow for two reasons. Only molecular gas can make stars, and even once you've turned the gas molecular, only 2% of the mass goes into stars per freefall time. The molecular fraction is determined by what might be called extrinsic properties. That is, the metallicity and the gas surface density required to make H2. On the other hand, once you've made a molecular cloud, its future evolution is determined by what might be called intrinsic physics. That is, it's internally turbulent, and that internal turbulence sets the star formation rate, and in turn, the internal turbulence is, and the column density in the gas are regulated by feedback from that very star formation. So this is a sort of microphysical picture of the process by which gas gets turned into stars. And I will end there.
I'll keep myself to one, obviously 100 things to ask, but it's heartening that you made so much progress without even mentioning fields. Now, field pressure does lots of interesting things that you know so much about. Do you want to give us a quick sense of what that will or will not do for you in the years ahead?
Sure. So magnetic fields, yeah, I gave a version of this talk at San Diego, and Frank Hsu was not pleased with me. So what are the roles of magnetic fields? So first of all, you have to distinguish whether magnetic fields are enough to make the cloud magnetically subcritical. So for those who are not MHD aficionados, I've got a certain amount of magnetic flux threading an interstellar cloud. If the amount is too large, then no matter what I do to that cloud, I cannot make it collapse because magnetic pressure always exceeds gravitational pressure. The good news for us is that observations seem to be coming down pretty firmly on the side of the magnetic fields not being that strong. So clouds are close to the critical line, but they're not over it. The typical molecular cloud is magnetically supercritical rather than subcritical, and this is work that Dick Crutcher has been doing over the last few years. All right, so you have magnetic fields there. They're not enough to stop collapse. What they can do is retard collapse, and what I didn't mention in my GMC model is that actually a significant fraction of the energy is being carried not in the kinetic energy of the turbulence, but in the magnetic energy associated with a fluctuating turbulent magnetic field. Right. So roughly half the energy of the turbulence is not in the form of motion, it's in the form of making the magnetic field wiggle. And that provides an effective pressure, which is in fact taken into account in those models. So what I'd say is the magnetic field acts as a sort of an aid to turbulence, or it acts like the turbulence. It doesn't act to completely turn off star formation as sort of the old ambipolar diffusion regulated model of star formation would have it. There are sort of large-scale correlations. The reason for that is that if you look at the power spectrum of the turbulence, most of the energy is on large scales. And if you look at the power spectrum of the magnetic field, you find exactly the same thing. Most of the power is on large scales. So it isn't like you've got little small-scale wiggles. The most power is in the biggest wiggles.
You showed those very generic arguments for the slowness and the low efficiency of star formation. Are they generic enough that they should also apply to the very intense starbursts at high redshift?
I would say that they should apply to any system that satisfies the conditions of being roughly virial and supersonically turbulent. And so, I mean, they apply to ARP 220. That's not quite as intense as some high redshift star formation. But yeah, I mean, anything that where the kinetic and potential energies are about equal, this argument should apply to. And in fact, if you take the sort of high redshift starbursts, as far as we can tell, they fall on the LIR-LHCN relation, more or less the same as the local ones. And that LIR-LHCN relation can be interpreted as simply a statement that the star formation rate is 2% per freefall time. The coefficient in that relation, the overall scaling of that line, is equivalent to 2% of the mass per freefall time.
Mark, can you show the plot of molecular surface density versus total gas as a function of metallicity?
Sure. Go back to that. Yeah.
Okay. So I think I agree with you that the data hugs the model at higher surface density, but I think it's fair to say that the data doesn't show a very sharp fall-off at low surface densities, right, which I agree with you, I would expect, because the transition from low column to high molecular fraction at particular column densities seems to be very sharp, say in Milky Way or SMC and LMC. So do you have any thoughts of what's going on? Why is the data?
Yeah, I think a large part of this is what I mentioned about clumping, that, you know, this is, I forget which galaxy this is, Leo, do you happen to remember? It's one of the ones from your sample, but, you know, the typical sort of beam averaging size in this survey is at least half a kiloparsec. All right, and depending on how distant the galaxy may be, it may be more than a kiloparsec. All right, so this is the column density smoothed over a KPC size scale. If I clump the gas, and we know gas is clumpy on size scale smaller than a kiloparsec, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put some of the mass into a high column density core that's going to have a higher molecular content, and then I'm going to have some of it in a lower column density outer envelope that will be all atomic. So I can increase the molecular content by clumping the gas. And I think that's likely what's responsible for going on here, is that, you know, this model is zero clumping and zero clumping.
And the comment I want to make about this plot, you mentioned that this may be interesting to people who work with dwarf galaxies. I think it should be interesting to everyone who works on galaxy formation, because low metallicity is what most galaxies have at redshift, say, 3, 5, 6.
Yeah, I think you're right. And actually, so something that I was reminded to specifically ask the dwarf galaxy people tomorrow is, what are the column densities of the dwarf galaxies, you know, the little dinky things that we're seeing around the Milky Way? Because that should have an influence on how they form stars. But yes, even for large galaxies at high redshift, this is going to be an important effect.
Just to add on to that, you know, in our paper, Andre didn't mention it, but you know, we model low mass dwarf galaxies, and so the star formation efficiency in those systems just dives because they don't have a lot of molecular gas, and that's you know, not only for the star formation in those galaxies is that important, but also in larger galaxies that are made of the accretion of those lower mass systems, it changes the nature of the way those baryons get into those galaxies. It comes in gaseous rather than in stars, and that can have implications as well.
Are there questions for Mark?
Everyone wants to go to lunch.
It's not to be the case, then. Let's thank all the speakers of the morning session.